key shift for me was deciding that success wasn't about becoming a, you know, famous or becoming well known or whatever that kind of warped idea of success is. It was about being the best actor I could be. And I basically decided, okay, I'm going to do work that I'm proud of. I'm going to be able to look at myself in the mirror and be proud of what I'm doing. If people see it, great, but they might not. So I just kept plugging away. It's 2 years since Offspring, so I haven't wanted to rush into something that doesn't resonate with me.
Yeah.
And I felt really good about doing this because it's the kind of show I would watch. It's written and created by writers that I love and have very long working relationships with. And I hope that people will receive Five Bedrooms as a show that's timely and fresh and it's its own show.
Welcome to the Seize the Yay podcast. Busy and happy are not the same thing. We too rarely question what makes the heart sing. We work, then we rest, but rarely we play, and often don't realise there's more than one way. So this is a platform to hear and explore the stories of those who found lives they adore. The good, bad and ugly, the best and worst day, will bear all the facets of seizing your yay. I'm Sarah Holloway, or Spoonful of Sarah, a lawyer turned funtrepreneur who swapped the suits and heels to co-found Matcha Maiden and Matcha Milk Bar. Seize the Yay is a series of conversations on finding a life you love and exploring the self-doubt, challenge, joy and fulfillment along the way. I'm sure I'm not alone in having been touched by this woman's career at some point or another in one of the many stellar roles she has portrayed that have made her an Aussie household name. Kat Stewart is one of our most outstanding actresses, winning many accolades for her talents, including the coveted Logie Awards. But as you'll hear today, despite her immense gratitude for the recognition she has earned, she is the ultimate professional and passionately dedicated to the art form, both in TV and theatre, and I loved her attitude of just putting her head down and getting the job done well. Extremely down to earth and originally from Bairnsdale, where one side of my family is from in country Victoria, she was such a pleasure to chat to. And I loved her honesty, not only about the very fun and glamorous side, but also the very nitty-gritty parts of forming an acting career. You may recognise her as Roberta Williams in Underbelly or Billy Proudman in Offspring, with many TV and theatre roles in between. But what I'm so excited about is Kat's new show, Five Bedrooms, on Channel 10. A comedy drama based on the disaster of buying property these days, it focuses on five different people who end up at the singles table at a wedding, get drunk, and eventually buy a house together, with each episode narrated by a different character. At the time of recording, it was just before the first episode of the show, but at the time of publishing right now, tonight is the first episode led by Kat's character, Liz. You'll hear more about it in this episode and should absolutely tune in tonight at 8:40 p.m. Kat, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, pleasure.
So excited. Having watched you for so many years, literally Kat just walked in the room and I was like, oh my God, she's real. It's a real human. Wow. And even more beautiful in real life.
Oh, God. Lies, but so nice. That's the beauty of podcasts.
Yeah. Got a great face for podcasting.
Yeah.
So the first segment of the podcast is called Way TA, which is pretty much the story right back from the very beginning of how you got to where you are. And I think that's where people who, you know, might be earlier on in their path or not sure what their path is get insights into sort of the fact that life is never linear, the journey always has lots of twists and turns. But before we get started, my first question is always, what's the most down-to-earth thing about you? And particularly when you're a household name, people have seen you win awards, have an incredibly stellar career as an Aussie icon, and knowing a little bit of, you know, the behind-the-scenes real relatable Kat is, yeah, always very reassuring for the rest of us that you're a human. So
I'm very human. most down-to-earth thing about me, I don't know, the first thing that pops into my head is as soon as I walk in the door, when I get home, the shoes come off and the UGG boots go on.
Nice.
UGG boot is my shoe of choice.
Oh, yep, nice.
Yeah, within the four walls of home. Yeah.
Only within the four walls, not to the supermarket.
No, I'm prepared to draw the line there.
Yeah. Well, you draw it better than I do.
And I don't know, I think I play down-to-earth people. Actually, well, this new show that we're talking about today is probably the first exception in a long time. She's a lot less down to earth, but generally speaking, I've always played down to earth characters.
Yeah, I'm so, so intrigued to actually find out a bit more about how you do switch from personas and then where your own persona fits in. But just to start off, let's go right back to the very beginning.
Yes.
So pre the acting career, in fact, pre a career, so young, young Kat.
Mm-hmm.
I have just found out that Kat is from Bensdale, which is where my dad's side of the family is from, went to Nagel College, which is a country town school. It's a very good school, but it's in Bensdale in Gippsland. So grew up in the country.
Yes.
Your dad was a solicitor who quit his job to take you guys travelling at the age of...
Yes, when I was eight and nine, so in the early 80s, very progressive.
Yes, I mean, so far ahead of his time.
Yeah, and when I went to school in London... For a while, we were doing correspondence, but I got lonely. So, yeah, my eyes were opened to a bigger world when I was about 8, 9, and that was an amazing experience for a kid growing up.
Yeah, what an incredible gift. So what was young Kat like? What were you like at school and, you know, did you always have your heart set on, you know, the arts, the performing arts?
No, look, that's the thing. Growing up in a small town and with parents that kind of had regular jobs, my mum was kind of at home with us. My dad was a solicitor, as you mentioned. I didn't imagine in a million years that the arts... I didn't know anyone who did that, so it wasn't something I kind of thought of. I think I was pretty introverted, not quite shy, but, you know, pretty low-key. I had the same best friend from kindergarten right through to year eight when I left Bensdale. So I had a really kind of solid, really good group of friends, which I still have to this day. And so young me was kind of very well-behaved. Did things by the book, really, but was very
good country
lucky.
Girl.
Yeah, yes, and very lucky to kind of have a very stable family and happy family, and it was a beautiful place to grow up in Bensdale. Mm. You know, everyone knew everyone. You kind of look out for each other. I know there are downsides of living in small country towns, but I think I didn't see any of that because I left when I was 14, so I only got the good side.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things it can be eventually, you know, ultimately limiting towards the end. But if you've had that beautiful country, safe, nurturing upbringing and then do get to move to Melbourne, you know, for the schooling part where you sort of want to be at parties and meeting boys and shopping, that's the best of both worlds.
Yeah, I mean, I left Bensdale kicking and screaming. I didn't want to go.
Oh, really?
I pined for all my friends and I was miserable for a couple of years. But then, you know, I came to see that there were definite upsides about being in the city, and I love being in the city.
So even though you didn't necessarily think you'd be an actress, I read that your love of school drama started around grade two.
That's right, yes.
So it was definitely there from the beginning.
Yes, Mrs. McManus, my grade two teacher, used to get us to enact stories. And, I, you know, as I said, I was quite, you know, quite low-key, quite not quite shy, but, you know, not a performer.
Yeah.
And but when we do plays, when I did acting, something changed. And all of a sudden I felt kind of right in my bones. And I loved it. And I did riskier things. And it kind of gave me permission to be somebody else, which I still love.
Yeah, that's so cool. And then you ended up doing, I think it was marketing and business at uni, is that right?
Yeah, arts and marketing at Monash. Yes,
yes, that's right. Yeah. So I'm a fellow Monash girl as well. And I actually read an article on you maybe a year ago. They published something in Monash Life and they published something about me at the same time. Oh. So weird.
Yeah.
And I'd been reading that you joined the theatre society at uni.
Yes.
So you'd come to Melbourne for school, and then how did you choose to do that degree and what did you think that would end up?
Well, like I said, a career in the arts wasn't really... I knew I loved drama. I was doing house drama at school in Melbourne, but I just didn't think that was an option as a career. So I thought... I knew I didn't want to do law or anything, you know, that world, which is what my dad and family came from. I thought business seemed kind of like a reasonable prospect, and I thought, well, marketing seemed like the most creative kind of business.
Mm.
So that's, but it was really just a process of elimination. It wasn't really a great plan,
per
se. So that's how I came to be doing business. And I was interested in psychology.
Yeah, I read you majored in
psychology and did a minor in cinema. So that kind of
kept me interested.
Yeah, yeah.
So interesting. I always think looking back at either what people did study or thought they'd study or were just, you know, inclined towards, how they got there and how what they thought at that time that would end up in, and if they ever had any idea that it would turn out how it did.
Never in a million years. Yeah, yeah. And I got involved with Theatre Society while I was at Monash, and quickly that became my passion. Like, it was like The study was kind of like the backup, but what I was really driven and interested in was the playmaking. Yeah,
that's so cool, and also really interesting that it started as more of a stage acting, not necessarily TV.
Yeah, no, and I mean, I couldn't get arrested on TV for ages. Like, I was doing a lot of my career started off being really theatre, which I love. I still love, you know, still doing theatre.
Yeah. And so when you graduated, your first job was in PR.
Yes.
And was that because you did think that you'd set yourself up, in marketing and in public relations?
Yeah.
And
well, it was just interesting. It was working as a publicist for Penguin Books. So it was a great...
Yeah, I did.
A great first job to get out of uni. And I had a ball doing that, in my early 20s, sort of setting up media tours for really interesting people, people who write books, so in all walks of life. So I do books on, cookbooks, comedians, great novelists. It was fascinating. So I loved that time. And
yeah.
At the same time, I was secretly, I was doing an acting course, a 3-year acting course at night.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So that's what I was going to ask.
Yes.
Did you know at that time that you wouldn't end up staying in that forever and you were sort of keeping acting alive as a side hustle?
I was hoping that acting was a stage and not that I would grow out of it.
Oh, wow.
Genuinely, because I knew by then, I knew enough to know that it wasn't a very secure profession.
Yeah.
And I also was, I liked the job I was doing. I enjoyed it. So I was, what can you do?
Yeah.
You love what you love.
Exactly. And I think one of the big things that I try to, encourage people through these stories is that once you do find something you love, as impossible as it might seem and as, not the smartest decision sometimes or not the securest decision that it might seem, that you do push through. And it is important, of course, to explore backups and to try other things and see whether or not you like it, because you might end up finding another passion.
But
it's interesting that acting was always alive in the background.
It was.
You couldn't let it go.
No, I couldn't let it go. And actually, there came a point, I remember when it was, in second year of my drama course, I got this great role in this really famous play called Angels in America, and it was the role of this great role, Harper. I remember it really clearly. And to do those performances, I wasn't going to be able to attend the Adelaide Writers Festival, which was not negotiable. So I actually had to make a choice between the two. And so I remember going to my boss at the time and coming clean and saying, guess what? You didn't realize this, but I've been doing an acting course, and I know it sounds crazy, and it sort of sounded embarrassing, actually. I was embarrassed almost because it seemed so mad. I'm going to have to resign because I need to do these performances.
Oh, my gosh.
The look on her face.
You're crazy.
Yeah. But she was right. But here we are. Yeah.
So that's, was that at the National Theatre? Is that when you
were? The National, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So this is so weird. I feel like we're the same person.
Yeah.
I was a ballerina with the Australian Ballet, but I started at the National.
Oh, wow.
I always knew there was a drama school attached to it, which is so cool. So I'm like, we probably spent a lot of time there together at the same time.
Yeah, in the same building. It's amazing.
So was that when, it's always interesting to find when people do decide to make the jump and that they're going to make a go of something. It wasn't until it became mutually exclusive, right?
I was prepared to hedge my bets for as long as possible.
Yeah.
And then I was able to get a job working for used to be called the AFI Awards. So I sort of felt like, which was less hours and worked well, and it was a short-term contract, 7 months or something. So I finished my course doing that and I was out. People knew I was... Yeah. Moonlighting them.
So between that and the big break, what was in between? What does it take?
About 10 years.
Wow. Okay, right. So it's funny. In all the reading material, I often find with anyone in any industry, but particularly in TV or acting or things that are quite publicly seen to look like an overnight success, they skate over this whole decade in between the really interesting bit at the beginning and then how you actually made it into, big, big roles that were... A Logie Award winning actress. So what did it take to get yourself in front of the right people? Was it a lot of networking? Was it finding agents? Was it just auditioning for everything?
It was, I had a really interesting journey. It was very challenging. So I got a couple of jobs straight off and I thought, this is fantastic. This is the way it's going to be. I'm going to build. I got a good agent. Off we had an agent's day. And so I was like, okay, I'm on my way.
Yeah.
The agency shut down after about 12 months.
Oh, my God!
And so did the jobs. Like, I was being sent for things, but it was a really good course that I did, but it was a theatre-based course. So I didn't have a lot of experience in the audition. They've changed the course, and I'm sure they're much better prepared now, but I wasn't really prepared for the auditioning process or for, screen acting, which is very different to theatre acting. And I think I wasn't very good at it. You know, it took a while to get the hang of what it was to audition well. And I basically, I found it really hard for a couple of years. I really was basically supporting myself with contract. Fortunately, I had a skill. I was able to work as a publicist.
So you kept that going?
I kept that going. Yep. I did contract work and bits and pieces and freelanced. But the acting wasn't. I was auditioning, but I wasn't getting the jobs, and I found that really challenging. And to call yourself an actor when you're not working, or call yourself an artist of any kind when you're not working, and it's that classic thing where you're an actor. So what would I know you from? And it's like, well, clearly nothing. You know, I'm not. It's early. You know, and it's really it's hard. Those early years are really really challenging. And I made a decision. It took me a while to come to it that I had to kind of modify my idea of what success was, because the truth of it was, and statistically, the likelihood was that it was never going to happen, because 90% of actors don't work at any given time. We have like a, I think it's like a 5 or 4% employment rate for acting. It's really bad.
Wow.
Yeah, it's quite sobering. So I kind of, my saving grace was that I got involved in Red Stitch Actors Theatre, which is a fabulous theatre company set up by 12 actors, really good actors, about 200 people auditioned for it, really great actors that basically said, well, we're going to create our own work, we're not going to wait for the phone to ring, we're not getting work, we're going to do our own. And we put on some really exciting work, but that for me meant that I was doing, you know, 6 plays a year, working all the time, building something. Then I started to call myself an actor, and I started to get better because I was exercising those muscles all the time. But I think the key, coming back to the point, the key shift for me was deciding that success wasn't about becoming a, you know, famous or becoming well known or whatever that kind of warped idea of success is. It was about being the best actor I could be. And I basically decided, okay, I'm going to do work that I'm proud of. I'm going to be able to look at myself in the mirror and be proud of what I'm doing. If people see it, great, but they might not. So I just kept plugging away. Mm. And then eventually it happened, but it might not have. And there are many, many, many actors out there who are as good as or better than me who haven't had recognition, and that's
a really tough reality of the industry.
It's the truth of it. You know, I got lucky eventually, but it took a while. Can I tell you, it took a while
creating that luck that would eventually come to you.
I've got to say, when I let go of that idea of, you know, what is it to be a successful actor, when I'm just doing the work and not getting swept up in the bullshit, just getting on with the work.
Just stripping it back and
just doing the best version of this play I could, creating this character with the most integrity I could, challenging myself the best that I could, that stuff fell away.
It's so interesting. That is one of the things I like to talk about a lot on the podcast, is how society defines success, how each individual then defines success, how that measures up, how you feel when you don't align, and how your fulfillment and happiness, as a totally separate matter, is really directly impacted by how you define what you think successful is. And if you change that, it can change everything.
Yeah, and I mean, it's harder now too, because, I mean, this is in the, you know, early 2000s. When I was sort of out and, you know, doing it hard sometimes, not hard, just, you know, struggling with unemployment and what success meant, and was I doing the right thing with my life. But it's harder now because of, you know, social media has changed everything, because we're all kind of presenting the best versions of ourselves, and we're editorializing our lives so much.
Absolutely.
So it's probably harder now than ever, I think.
And the comparison as well. I think before that, you didn't really necessarily know what everyone else was doing. So you could just put your head down, concentrate on your own stuff, whereas now it's so visible that blah has this role and blah's doing this.
And And I think we used to be a lot more delicate about, or Australian, in sort of saying, oh, look, I'm doing this job. Who knows how it'll go?
Yeah.
Because you've been sensitive to the fact that your mate isn't working.
Yeah,
but now
totally.
It's like, hey, you scored a new role and blah, 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 blah. So we're always blowing our own trumpets now. It's very different. Yeah.
Which is lovely in a way, but it's also, I can imagine, quite challenging. Yeah. So did you at that time want to focus, were you looking to move into screen in a more permanent role, or was it just that it came up and you sort of thought, I'll give it a go?
I was looking to work.
Yeah,
and I think you just audition for what's on. There's no grand plan. You just audition for what's in front of you. And I do think, though, I mean, of course, as time goes by, you're able to become a bit more selective about the work you do.
Like,
I'm not. But early on, you want to be seen.
So, you just take what's there.
The thing I started to realise, you know, any actors that might be listening, or probably. This case in a lot of disciplines, is that I would go for auditions knowing I wasn't the right person.
Yeah.
But it's an opportunity to build a brand. So you go in and you do the most interesting version of that inappropriate character that you can possibly do. Yeah. So that they go, okay, clearly what was I thinking getting her in here? But that's interesting.
For another role.
Remember her for, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So how do you prepare once you get given a brief? So what I originally saw you in was as Roberta Williams
in
Underbelly, yep. Which was such an incredible show. I'd read all the books. You know, I'd been really fascinated in the story beforehand. I don't know why. I think I'd read the book knowing that the TV show was coming out. Mm-hmm. Anyway, had followed it quite closely and was just so fascinated by everyone's ability to get into character without being able to actually sit down with these people necessarily and study them, but also portray something that had been in the media, that had been, you know, so heavily looked at by the population, and then have that weight on your shoulders of, you know, creating those roles and then portraying it in such a way. How do you sit once you get a role like that? What's your process for kind of getting into character, creating that character and warming into it?
Well, actually, it sort of harks back to what we were just talking about, weirdly. It's that idea of, you know, not caring about, not letting whether this is going to go down well or not affect your choices. So I'd come from years just, you know, doing recurring roles on things and guest spots and stuff, but essentially having a theatre career. And so I had nothing to lose.
Yeah.
It wasn't a pretty role.
Yeah.
Quite the opposite.
Which is another interesting thing, I thought. How do you prepare yourself for that?
Well, I didn't know any better. So yeah. I just went in and I just threw myself at it. It was such a great opportunity and the writing was electric and I didn't know how big the role was going to be even because they were so secretive about the scripts and stuff.
Oh.
So she just kept turning up. It was fantastic. I loved the role. But I just concentrated on the job and I didn't know it was going to be successful. So I just threw myself into the role and treated it like a theatre role.
Do you do a lot of research and, like, watch videos of her, like, footage of her,
well,
or how do you...
wasn't as much... I mean, she's super famous now, but she wasn't as visible back then.
Yeah.
So, but I was lucky I was able to... We spent a lot of time with the Piranha police.
Right.
And a lot of those guys had been privy to a lot of, you know, surveillance as well as face-to-face contact. And I had access to court documents, so I was able to read a lot about her diabolically awful childhood, which sort of was a real key for me as well in terms of just trying to get some understanding about where she was coming from. But then, you know, I didn't have access to her, so it was a leap of a work of imagination with the writers and the directors and stuff. But such a rich, fabulous role.
Yeah.
And just, you know, with a role like that, you think, is this too much? And you think, well, hang on, actually, it's not.
Am I too extra?
I know it's not because, you know, I've heard this recording, I've seen this, you know, footage or, you know, so she's just such a marvellously rich character to play.
Did you ever worry about her seeing it or any of her family members seeing it?
Yeah, look, someone asked me about this today, you know, are you still following what's happening? And I absolutely am. I became so invested in her and her welfare. I want her to be okay.
Yeah.
I really do. And of course I cared about what she thought. But I understood that it would be very strange for her. And it wasn't a documentary. It was, you know...
A TV show.
So I'm not surprised she wasn't a fan. I think she's mellowed a little bit in the intervening years, but I can imagine it would be incredibly confronting for her. And also, in the years since, you know, she's had such tragedy in her life.
Mm.
So I have a lot of empathy for her, yeah.
Yeah, and it would be so different, I think, playing a role of a person who exists
yes.
compared to, you know, a fictional role that
yes.
you have no one to tell you that that's not what they're like. Or
Yeah, it's a massive responsibility, and we all felt it too because a lot of us, you know, we were shooting in Melbourne and it wasn't just this is good for a laugh. It was that people have lost...
People's lives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dads and sons and brothers and, you know.
Did you find that generally hard? Just generally, as an actress, do you find sometimes it difficult to separate who you are from the role that you're playing in the time?
No. And I think, I mean, look, I think my fashion sense gets a bit blurred.
That's nice.
A weird thing. Yeah, if I can find at the end of a shoot, I'll go, I have to have that shirt, I have to have it. Can I buy that?
I'm just taking this home.
Very rarely do you get given things in Australia. It may be different in the States, I don't know. But then I'll get it home and want to, what was I thinking? That's not me, that's the character. I'd never wear that in a million years. So that I blur in that way.
Yeah.
But I think if you've got a sense of, like, I you know, I'm a grown up. It's like, I think it might be different if you're getting into this as a 16-year-old.
Yeah, totally.
But, you know, I've got a family and stuff, so no, I can certainly leave it. I mean, you might be tired from the day's shoot or...
But you don't come home in character or anything.
God, how terrifying you with my family.
Well, I always wonder that, you know, because it does, your portrayal of her character was so deep and rich that I would, just in my own mind, I think how hard that would be to switch that off. And even when I hang around with friends, I bring home half their mannerisms.
Yeah, like,
imagine if I did that within my own body as a character.
While I was doing it, the character was such that she kind of made me braver because I couldn't.
Yeah.
I remember sort of making this contract with myself that she was so gutsy, I couldn't
shirk.
I had to be gutsy too. So I remember I'd had a big night. I've told this story before, but I remember having a big night while I was shooting that, someone's birthday, and deciding to get the classic, you know, Hungry Jack's at, you know, 1 a.m, whatever it was. And I decided I wanted a sundae, and I asked for extra topping. And some smarty pants behind me said, ooh, she wants extra topping. And I remember just turning around. I said, yeah, you got a problem with that, mate?
Oh,
and just giving him the Roberta. And it just came out of me and went,
whoops.
And he didn't say anything. And I didn't say anything. It was just like,
wow.
Yeah.
So she pops out.
But that was a long time ago. And occasionally in bad traffic. But
yeah.
Apart from that, I've got her under
You've
control.
Got triggers.
Yeah.
So how did that feel, you know, going from struggling or, you know, not feeling like you particularly had a name to becoming a household name, becoming infinitely recognisable, and also then the recognition that started streaming in, like the AFI Awards? Nominated for 2 Logies and then won one for Most Outstanding Actress. What was that transition like?
Well, that's the thing. Like, when you're not concentrating on that, if that's not your key performance indicator, if it's actually the... but it's true.
Yeah,
if
I mean, honesty
not,
is
if that's not how
the best
you're
policy.
Rating... Of course, that's lovely. Don't get me wrong. I loved getting that recognition. It was lovely that it was so well-received. It's lovely that other things I've done have been, you know, well-received. But you just can't afford to get caught up in that because you take your eye off the ball.
Mm.
You've got to make sure the work's good. Also, it wasn't... If you're talking about Underbelly, when I first kind of got a bit of notice... that wasn't screened in Melbourne. So I know that...
That's right.
Yeah.
The court case was on, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was banned.
Right,
I know it was a pretty intense experience for the Sydney cast. Those guys were doing nightclub appearances and having a lovely time. But I was doing, you know, a few days a week on Sean McCaleb's Newstopia on SBS and just pottering around.
Yeah.
No one had seen it. So I didn't...
Feel
my
bad.
Life didn't change in a heartbeat, but also I was... You know, just keeping my eye on whatever else I was working on at the time.
And then how did that transition from that to then Offspring, completely different context, which again went for 7 years of another incredible chapter of your career?
Yeah, that was the gift that kept giving. But you don't know when you start.
Yeah.
And you did a pilot and you think...
Could go well.
Yeah, and after each series you go, oh, well, gee, we had a good run, that was good. And you kind of come to terms with the fact that that's it, because you need to.
Yeah.
And then, you know, a few months later you get the phone call saying, been greenlit again, and that's fantastic. So, but it happens so gradually. And in the meantime, I'd done Tangled for Foxtel. We did 3 series of that, and that was an amazing experience. I don't know.
There's just so much in between, isn't there, that no one really knows?
Yeah, yeah, you do lots of things in between. And honestly, it's just one day at a time.
Yeah.
It's only when I talk on days like this, you go, oh, well, gee. Okay, that was pretty good, wasn't it? I'm just pottering along, doing my thing.
But I think that's amazing. You make it so relatable that you're like, it's a job. I mean, it's super, super glamorous on the outside, but I'm just working.
No,
I'm just doing my thing.
Honestly, and if anyone ever comes to a film set, you'll see that we're in caravans.
Yeah.
There is nothing
glamorous.
We're in caravans. We're up at, you know, sometimes 4:30 in the morning. Coffee's pretty good now, actually.
That's
the coffee
great
game now. They always have someone decent making coffee. But it's, you know, it's rough and ready and the days are long and you spend a lot of time in dressing gowns and, you know, just polo fleeces just hanging around waiting to go on, and it's not in the least bit glamorous.
I love that stuff. Tell us more about that. Did you think that, do you guys have any idea that Offspring would go for 7 years?
No.
And how do you make space for being a character for 7 years and evolving with her?
It was such a privilege to, A, work on that show, which you know, it evolved. I caught an early episode of something from the first series, and it changed. So, like, it evolved, and it didn't necessarily know what it was straight away, but it was fresh, you know.
Yeah.
It had explosions and stuff in the first couple of episodes. It was something else.
Yeah.
It had an energy about it, and it had such a beautiful cast and such good writers. It was just such a great ride to go on. And I loved the character from very early on. She's pretty spiky to start with, but we kind of, by about episode five, I thought, okay, I'm starting to get what this is. And I loved every minute of it. And, you know, I never took it for granted. Every recommission was a thrill.
So you don't know until, like, the very end of a season, do you, if it's going to be renewed for the next
one?
No,
they wait to see. I mean, I think it varies, but we wouldn't know until it had been on air.
Wow.
So it's quite a waiting game. So you might be optioned. You might be optioned for three series, but yep, it's their option, not ours. We're waiting to hear.
Right. This is all the behind-the-scenes stuff that no one knows. You literally just turn on your TV and you go, oh, my gosh, Kat Stewart, like, seven seasons of this. Amazing. She would have known and felt really secure and, like, chill about that whole thing.
No, you never feel secure as an actor. That's one thing I can guarantee.
And so when that finished, you had again had some incredible recognition in actor awards, and actor as in AACTA, not ACTOR, and more nominations for the Logies. And you've mentioned that obviously that's not necessarily what you were aiming for, and that
I'm very grateful. But
how did that feel then to know? I mean, in your world, you're probably just doing your job, but on the outside, people starting to recognise you all the time, you know, and knowing you for roles. And do you watch the episodes? Like,
I do.
How does that all feel?
Yeah, no, I get really excited, and I don't think I can't imagine getting jaded about that stuff, because it's killing me. I can't watch the premiere tonight because I'm going to be at the theatre. I'm doing a play. I can't watch. I have seen the first episode, so that's something. But I like watching it live.
Yeah.
Exciting.
When the nation's watching with you.
Yeah, I like to know. It's kind of, I want to be part of that.
Yeah.
So I find that incredibly exciting. And I like to see how people feel about it. You know, I'll have a look at what social media is saying, whether it's going down well or not. Hopefully well.
Yeah, I was also going to say, do you sometimes not want to look and just wait it out and see?
No, I'm hopeless.
Yeah.
I wish I didn't care, but I do.
Yeah. Is it weird being famous? Like, do you feel it?
I don't feel famous. I don't. And the thing is, I mean, you've probably got a sense of the fact that I don't go around with a cloak asking people to notice me, you know?
Yeah, sunglasses. Yeah, totally.
I just potter around. And so I think, and I live in Melbourne. It's a very low-key city.
Yeah.
So sometimes someone will go, oh, hello, and hello, you know, we might have a chat, but it's not, you know, I'm not like proper famous.
We think you are.
Just go about
what you do. You just do your life.
Yeah.
So that brings us to the new show, which is airing tonight.
Yes.
So at the time of recording, it is airing literally tonight. So how do you feel? How do you feel on that day, knowing you've done the work for this episode? You've watched it now, but have you usually watched it before it airs the first time?
It's nice to have. I usually have had the opportunity to watch it with, there's usually sort of a cast crew screening or something.
Is there apprehension before something comes out?
I love it. And I know we're kind of obligated to say that. I'm looking over at Laura, the lovely
publicist
in the corner. We are obligated to say that. But I really do, and I only want to – look, it's an imperfect world, but ideally you work on stuff that resonates with you.
Mm-hmm.
And I've kind of – it's 2 years since Offspring, so I haven't wanted to rush into something that doesn't resonate with me.
Yeah.
And I felt really good about doing this because it's the kind of show I would watch. It's written and created by writers that I love and have very long working relationships with.
Yeah, some of them are from Offspring.
The two creators are long-term Offspring writers and are very, very clever, Michael Lucas and Christine Bartlett. They created this. This is their baby with the very clever people at Hoodlum. And I just think it's... Look, we're a very sophisticated audience now.
Mm.
We all watch... a ton of Netflix and international content. We can't just give people sausages and say, look, there we are, tick that box, we've done some Australian content. We need to make sure it's fresh and original. I hope that people will receive Five Bedrooms as a show that's timely and fresh and of its own show. And I mean, obviously there are comparisons with Offspring because I was in Offspring and because the writers were, but I'd like to think that it stands up on its own 2 feet. It's its own show, and I'm really proud of it. And I think the performances in it are sublime. It's got Stephen Peacock, Hugh Sheridan, Katie Robertson, Roy Joseph, Doris Umame, beautiful, Kate Jenkinson, beautiful actors, yeah. And it's a true ensemble show. I'm not the star of it. We take turns to narrate each episode, and it's really beautifully weighted in that way. And it's smart, and it's kind of what it does share with Offspring, I guess, is that generosity. Mm. It's dealing with people's flaws, mm. but at its heart, it's inclusive and generous, which I love.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of the trailers, and it looks like such a fun show.
Yeah, it is.
and full of emotion and just heart, relatability, yeah. and heart. Mm. So tell us about the concept. It's called Five Bedrooms.
Yes.
Tell us what we can expect. It's a comedy drama.
Yes, so the basic setup is we've got five people, different, you know, in their 20s through to their 40s, different kind of backgrounds, walks of life. These five people find themselves on the singles table, you know, near the speakers, the end of the back of the hall at a wedding.
And this is the Indian wedding. Was it an Indian wedding?
It's, like it's, it is an Indian kind of Anglo,
yeah.
interesting mix of people. And these guys, some of them know each other a bit, but not that well. And they get really drunk, as you do.
Yeah.
Quite a desperate kind of wedding situation. You just want the night to get through the night.
Yeah.
And they're bemoaning the fact that they can't afford real estate on their own, how hard it is to get into the market as a single person. And they get drunker and they decide to buy a house together. And they actually do. They get the first house they've been on. So that's the setup. And it's really interesting to see these people that wouldn't necessarily have dinner together do this. You know,
such
live in a house
social
together.
Experiment.
It is. But it's also, it was inspired by an article that the writers read. You know, this is something that's a viable kind of option, I think.
Well, it's a very topical issue. I read another article that has since tied that whole theme back to the release of the show, which was just saying that it's almost an actual commentary on the state of the property market right now, that none of us can afford to buy houses by ourselves.
It's so, like, my parents bought their first house for $10,000, fully furnished. Can you believe it?
It's crazy.
It's nuts. Yeah, so
crazy.
It's so hard now.
And so your character is Liz.
Yes.
Bankrupt, divorced.
Yes.
Going through a tough time.
No, that's all in there. She's a very successful lawyer, and she's got a lot of status anxiety. You know, she's always owned a lot of property. She's been very successful, high flying. Marriage, you know, very glossy.
And ticks all the boxes.
She's always done everything by the book. And she's earned that, you know.
Yeah.
And it seems so unfair that now she's divorced and her finances are all tied up in this disastrous divorce. And she can only afford to get into the market again this way.
Yeah.
And she's living with her best friend and a whole lot of people she doesn't know. So that's her situation. And, she's a lot... She's very different to characters I've played. I've tended to play characters that are a little bit unhinged or a little bit unguarded.
Slightly psycho.
Lacking in filters. But she's very much, she's got a lot of armour up. And, what I love, she's kind of a bit of a slow burn and probably a bit of a challenge. There are many lovable characters in the show. She's probably not so lovable initially, at least, but I love her complexity.
Mm.
I think she's really, she's worth sticking with, I find. And she's very fragile. She's got a whole lot going on under the surface that we learn about as the show progresses, and she makes a lot more sense as we go.
Even one of the trailers that I saw, I think one of the really powerful things about the character is that she does come across as very together and powerful and used to having her shit together, but really is forced through this whole situation to be vulnerable, which is, I think, a very hot topic in society of people having this exterior that's really together and being like total clusterfuck under the surface and showing that vulnerability to strangers and it being received in such a loving, nurturing way is almost giving, you know, the audience permission to just be a bit vulnerable. Like everyone's... got a soft, messy spot inside.
Yes, and I think you're right. It's what we touched on earlier about, you know, how we put our best face forward, especially, you know, socials and everything else. And, everyone has their burden to bear. Mm. Everyone has a story. And, these characters surprise each other and take each other out, way out of their comfort zones.
Yeah.
And it's a fantastic alchemy to see what happens to them.
Yeah, I'm so just from watching that, I was like, what happens?
Yes.
It's such a fascinating premise to sort of...
It is.
A melting pot of different people at different stages in their life, and we're all curious to see what would happen if we did that.
Yes. And all that, I must say, credit to the writers, the characters are not cookie cutter. We're not dealing with archetypes. We're dealing with full-blooded, interesting characters, and each week, you know, you sort of taken through a different character's sort of perspective, and so that's a great way in.
Yeah, so at the time of recording, the first episode is airing tonight, but at the time of release, it will be just before episode 4, which is when Liz's first episode of narrating. So it'll be really, really interesting to see how that one goes down. Mm. So I also have a question I've wanted to ask an actress or an actor for so long, and I wonder if it's a trade secret, so no pressure to reveal the answer.
Okay.
But one of the scenes in the bit that does show Liz being quite vulnerable in the trailer is you breaking down into tears, just it all washing over you, like it's just getting a bit much. I'm just, how am I here? I'm divorced. I'm bankrupt. I'm sitting on the couch. And I'm always, always like, how do you make yourself cry on cue? How do you do that? Because I cannot. And I just don't know. I can't imagine a world where I would be able to do it without just, totally making a mess of it.
Kids can do it like that.
Yes.
I don't know. It's interesting, isn't it? My kid's just straight to tears. I want Vegemite, not honey.
How do you turn it on and then turn it off?
I mean, if we're just talking, if you said cat cry now.
You couldn't. Yeah.
No, I have to put myself in the given circumstances. So some people have tricks. You know, they might go back to a painful memory or that kind of stuff. I don't do that. I'm very much, I just believe what's happening.
Yeah, okay.
And sometimes that...
And it's an emotional moment
and
for her.
Sometimes... But I think it's I hate it when a script says she breaks down crying. It's just like, it becomes a thing you have to do.
Yeah.
But actually if the situation is strong enough, that will probably happen. But the main thing is to tell the truth of the scene, not to get to tears. But I find that I'm quite emotional. It doesn't take much to get ads can make me cry. Given the right time of the month, really.
Let's film this episode on that day. I've always wondered, I'm like, do they put drops in your eyes?
And you can do that. Yeah.
Oh, that happens?
Yeah, totally. So sometimes you might have a really emotional scene and so you'll cry for the close-up, but then, you know, you need to get to the long shot and you need to look teary.
And you can't see.
Or maybe you're just not feeling like crying that day. That can happen too. So they have these things called tear sticks. It's like menthol and they can blow it into your eye.
Oh.
It makes...
Oh my gosh. Okay.
So there are cheats.
Yes,
there are
okay.
Things you can do.
Yeah, because I was like, surely not every actor and actress ever can just turn it on, like at the drop of a hat. And also, like, waterworks turn it on. Like,
and sometimes, you know, you might be shooting that scene for a day and a half.
Yeah.
You would die if you were, you know, no. So sometimes you need a bit of help.
And do you ever forget, like, is part of the experience that you are able to kind of block out all the cameras and stuff that are around you? Because I always think, particularly with things like sex scenes or really intense emotional scenes where I would be infinitely aware that there's like 20 people in the room and I'm not just in this intimate moment, I'd be like, whoa, that's someone over there that I work with. Do you just become oblivious to that as you're getting into the scene? Or you just learn to work with it?
Yeah, I think that's a hard one to kind of articulate, because I remember when I first started working on film and TV, I found... The experience of acting in front of a crew and the fact that they touch you right before take, you know, do checks and, you know, fix your hair and touch your top and stuff and do your makeup. And then they'd say action and be like, oh.
But I'm still cat getting my makeup
still,
done.
Still, so that took me a little while to get used to. But actually you become very close to the crew.
Yeah.
And they become like your little, your partners. You're making it together, and they're also your kind of your audience as well as your collaborators.
Yeah.
So I've been very lucky to work with. I mean, Australian crews are pretty fabulous.
Yeah.
So they kind of become your. I don't know. It's like a dance you do together.
Yeah.
And you kind of work out who's got a sense of humour on the crew and stuff, and you kind of sort of see how it's going based on certain people, as well as the director, of course. And so no, that becomes kind of part of it. And even the last-minute checks I now enjoy, because that's part of the getting ready to do
process.
A take. It kind of, it's like your ready, steady, go moment.
Yeah.
And with theatre, I don't like it when I can see, when it's lit in a way that I can see the audience.
The faces,
I like it,
yeah. Kind of
a mess, but I don't know, the audience become your friends.
Yeah.
Because you're doing it for them, God.
Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. Mm. I've like literally always wanted to ask those two questions. Yeah. So with the stage acting, which you are doing at the same time, you've got a new show coming up and have been, more than 10 years with the Red Stitch Theatre
now. I did
10
years with them, and I have not done a play there for quite a few years now, but I have been doing, every couple of years I try and do a play to keep my hand in because I love it. And it's harder with kids.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I stopped doing as much theatre when I had my son 7 years ago, but... So I haven't done a play in 2 years. This is my first play in 2 years.
Wow.
But I love it.
Is it easy for you to switch between the disciplines?
It's different muscles.
Yes, okay.
Definitely different muscles.
Yeah.
But no, the basic principles are the same. It's, you know, you want to work on great scripts and you want to play interesting characters and you want to work with great people. So all the basics apply. But, yeah, they are different muscles. And it's a different kind of physical experience, you know, working at night and sort of doing... a show as a in sequence as opposed to bits and bobs, you know.
Yeah, that would be so jarring being like, we're shooting this that's after the thing that you're doing. Like,
yeah. So that's kind of just a different kind of, there's just different muscles, but the essentials are the same.
And what about film? I think you've dabbled in a couple of films. Mm. Would you ever, like, is that also completely different to TV in episodes or is it very similar?
Look, I've done supporting roles in film. I've never done a lead role in film and I'd love to. Look, they're not that different. You get a bit more time, but in Australian films they're often so low budget, it's very similar to shooting TV.
Yeah.
But also, like, TV used to be the poor second cousin and it's just not now. Mm. Like, TV is really where it's at. So
it's consumed so
regularly. I don't see them as so different, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And have you ever set your sight on different markets? Would you ever go to, you know, your Hollywood or your...
I'd love to work overseas, but not at the cost of my kids or my lifestyle.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I'm just not interested in going over and leaving my family behind and, you know, just couch surfing in my 40s. I can't think of anything else. Sounds like a kind of hell.
Which is kind of like a, you know, path, a right path that you have to do.
Yeah.
Initiation into Hollywood.
And look, I think about the overseas markets when I'm not working here. You know, things are a bit quiet here. I think, oh, gee, maybe I should. But look, my preference is to work here, so I'm so happy. So if I'm doing interesting work I'm excited about, I'm more than happy to keep plugging away here. And, of course, if I got asked to do something over there, of course I'd do it. But
I'm
not going to schlep with a young family. It just doesn't feel right to me.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you have more than enough things on your plate without adding that as well.
It's a year-to-year proposition, but at the moment I'm so happy where I am. Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. So moving on to the next segment, this is NATA, which is all the things that get in the way of your joy along the way. Just the challenges that kind of face, you know, anyone going through any kind of career or any kind of life, particularly when you do add children to the mix or when you are in an industry that's not, by its nature, unlike law or unlike some of the professions, very, very predictable and stable. Mm. Acting is an industry that is, you know, unpredictable. Mm. I didn't realise quite how unpredictable it can be with not even knowing that each season within a show would be renewed until the very last minute. Mm. What are some of the challenges along the way that you've struggled with? Like, self-doubt is a really big one. Mm-hmm. It's a big theme of this podcast that it's by our nature, particularly as women, it's very a natural self-protection mechanism to just doubt our abilities in everything, to doubt that we'll be good enough to get another job, to not even put ourselves forward because we think everyone will hate us, doubt what we look like, what our body image is doing. You know, that's just a recurring, resounding theme.
Yeah, I'd just like a drink now.
Have we got an hour? And then also... entering motherhood, that adds a whole nother level of mum guilt. And you have a career, you want to be a career woman and be a mum and a family woman. Burnout then from having all of those things going.
God.
This is how we get the tears going.
Oh, God. No, look, you've got to believe in what you're doing. But criticism is tough, you know. And I think, you know, to be an artist of integrity, and you kind of have to be alive and you have to be a sensitive soul to actually do good work. Mm-hmm. So, of course, criticism's going to burn you. So that's part of it. And everyone, it's not like people go around, you know, critiquing people's spreadsheets. But they are very happy to critique people's performance.
Yes.
You know, their acting or their singing or their, you know, public kind of, or their painting, you know.
And I love it how it's always in areas that the criticizer has no skill.
Absolutely, but it's
absolutely no ability.
But having said that, there is merit in the fact that an acting performance should, it is subjective, but it should resonate with somebody. And if it doesn't, it doesn't.
Mm.
And, you know, people are welcome to have their opinions about that. But, yeah, no, criticism's hard. And look, I tell you what, the auditioning process is hard because every time you audition for something, you don't get it. It's personal because it's not your painting. I didn't do a good painting. They're looking at you.
Yeah.
They're choosing not you today.
Yeah, specifically.
You specifically. I don't like you enough.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I like this person more, or you're not famous enough, or whatever it is. So I think the mental health, they did some MEAA, which is the Actors Union, did a big research project into mental health of artists and actors in particular. And it's not for the faint-hearted because the things we were talking about in terms of job instability, rejection, it's not for the faint-hearted. It's really challenging. And you'd be a very rare person not to find it challenging at different points. But then, you know, the upside is if you love, that's not what we were talking about before, if you love something, you just gotta. It's not really a choice. If you really love something, you just want to do it. And so for all the quiet times that you inevitably get, especially starting out, there's the thrill of creating something with like-minded people. The idea of understanding, the root of what I love about acting is understanding what makes us human. To me, that is the most thrilling part of what we do. And I've had the opportunity to work on characters that are not palatable on the page. And trying to look at someone else who is different to me, trying to look at the world through their eyes and get an understanding. And that gives you great insight. It makes you a better human. And if you can take the audience along for that ride too, it's just magical. So it's such a privilege to explore the human condition and to, as people, to kind of, you know, sit in a darkened theatre or watch television as a group or with your friends on Twitter, whatever it is, and watch stories and understand people better. And what a thrilling thing to do for a job. So, yeah,
absolutely.
Look, there's insecurity and there are downsides and, you know, but...
Your focus keeps you going.
I don't want to do anything else.
Yeah.
And it's not work. It's a passion. I love it.
That's
it makes
amazing.
Me happy. So even though it's a tough mistress sometimes, I don't want to do anything else.
I also feel like anything worth having, it doesn't come easy.
Yeah.
And if it does come easy, it's probably not worth having.
Yeah.
There's a fight in everything and that's part of it. That's part of building the resilience that you need to weather the storm and then to end up, you know, with more experience, with more appreciation of where you are, because if it was too easy, you know.
Well, yeah, I must say, you know, I think it would be really hard to get astonishing success as an 18-year-old.
And I not think, ever appreciate the struggle. I think so too.
Because I think when the applause dies down, I think that would be really, I think that would be really hard.
Mm.
You know, you look, a lot of child actors have very tough lives, you know. So I think it's not a bad thing to understand how fortunate you are. I never take working for granted ever.
Yeah. What would you say to any aspiring young actors or actresses out there who are facing that part where it does seem like nothing's ever going to happen? Because there, I'm sure in everyone, and I've had Megan Gale on last week, and it's similar in the modelling industry, that if you don't fit a certain look or a certain role in someone's subjective eyes, it's a no, and just until it's a yes. Mm. And the moment that you quit is often the minute before you're about to hit a big break. So what advice would you have for someone just to hang in there until the next one? Because you could have quit many times along the way before knowing even that Offspring was even a twinkle in someone's eye, or that Underbelly was even an idea in someone's head.
Mm.
But you do have to hang on. So what gets you through? What are some things that maybe people could do in the meantime?
Well, I think it comes down to what makes you happy. And I don't think you need to be stubborn to the point of, I've said I would be an actor, so I'm going to be an actor at all costs.
Mm.
Don't do that. Don't do that.
Not a good idea.
It's you know, as we said, over 90% unemployment. Don't do it. If you can be happy doing something else, do something else. But if it's what burns inside you, if it's what you really want to fight for, then you have to. So do that.
Mm.
But you don't... I don't think you should do it unless you really, really want to. But if you really want to, just do it. And as I said, the big adjustment for me was making it about the work, not the outside stuff, because that's true. That will hold you in good stead, because the other stuff will come and go. I remember talking to a brilliant actor called Bob Hornery, who's like a theatre legend. And this is, you know, 15 years ago, I worked with him on a play at MTC. And I said to him, Bob, have you been famous? Because he was like, you know, 80 or something. And he said, oh, darling, several times. That's such a great attitude, because you can't control that stuff.
Yeah.
All you can control
is what you're doing.
The work. Make sure your work is good.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it would be a lot, very, very helpful advice for a lot of people out there to just focus on the work and not the end result, because you can get really bogged down.
Well, we're not here for a long time.
Yeah.
I appreciate this more as I get older, and I lost my mum 3 years ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And that kind of puts things in perspective, and having kids too, you realise that we're not, it feels like it's going to go forever, but it doesn't. We're here for a few decades. That's it. So you can spend all your time, and I was guilty of this, especially in my 20s, I will be happy when. And when I'm this weight, when I've got this job, when I've got this recognition. No, make sure you're happy today, because all we have at the moment
is now.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
I always say, if your head is always in the next minute, what happens to the one you're in?
Exactly.
And we are. We spend our whole day, and particularly through digital, either in the future, in someone else's future, in someone else's yesterday, and there's not a lot of right now.
Yeah, yeah. And which isn't to say you shouldn't plan. Totally.
Yeah,
plans,
yeah, yeah.
But
with just, appreciation.
Yeah, but make sure you're doing something you love.
Yeah. Yeah. So that brings us to the last segment, which is the things that you love, the things that make your heart sing. It's called Play TA. And I think this came about for me because I've realised that this productivity hamster wheel that we're all on and this goal-kicking, you know, girl boss, whatever kind of society, which is absolutely amazing. We're a society of productivity and speed and pace, and that's amazing because it allows incredible things to happen. It allows shows to get produced. It allows people to change careers, and it's a very, very exciting time to be alive. But I think as we get very much down the success pathway, we lose a lot of... we lose sight of the joy pathway and I think people get very, very far down pathways and realize they're not happy at all. They've got everything that they should have, you know, that should have been everything they wanted, and are not actually happy or fulfilled. And people aren't making time for joy. They're not making time for what makes them feel alive. It's incredible. My first question was, do you get happiness from your job, and would you be doing this if you had no money or time constraints? I imagine you would be doing exactly what you're doing.
I'm afraid so.
Which is the best answer that you could possibly have. But unfortunately, I think a lot of people aren't in that position.
And as life gets hard, you know, when you have family and responsibilities, sometimes you have to do things you don't want to do too. So
absolutely.
I'm with the recognition of that too.
Which is the other reason why this Play TA concept is that you don't necessarily have to find joy in your work, because work is called work for a reason. Since the age of time, it hasn't always been about instant gratuity, but joy is meant to be somewhere.
Yes.
So even if it's outside of your job, do you have hobbies, or do you have a pursuit that does make you feel like you're living and not just existing? So for you, in between your roles and your role as a mother, so Kat as a mom, Kat as an actress, Kat as a stage actress, a TV actress, what do you do that's just for you as a person, and that's your joy? Do you do anything that's just a hobby, like for fun, or are you completely fulfilled by work so that you don't need that?
I am quite time poor.
Yes, I imagine there is not a lot of time left over.
At the moment, you know, look, last year I had some time off, which was lovely, but I am quite time poor at the moment. My joy is I've got a 3-year-old and a 7-year-old, so like it's gold. Like it's a golden time, especially I think 3 is a really special age. So that's just magic. And I've got to say, I don't have a lot of time for much else, and I don't try and get to the gym a couple of times a week. That's it, really.
Look on your face right now.
I don't have any time to do anything but work and be a mum. But look, that's common, and I know it won't be as intense as this in even 5 years.
Yeah.
But it's just what it is now.
Yeah.
But I'm not complaining, because I'm fortunate in the work that I do satisfies the joy component, and also I have, you know, my kids are mad but delightful, you know.
I also think that having young children is probably, from a mindfulness perspective and snapping you into the moment so you can't ever get too far ahead and carried away in anxious, you know, thoughts about 5 years' time, is that children's needs are so immediate that you have to be in the now.
Absolutely.
So you can't get too far down, you know, the wrong path.
And sometimes, you know, my three-year-old just say, play with me, mummy. And I'm like, I've got a million, I don't really want to, but you think, hang on, what if she stops asking? And so you sit down and you play for 10 minutes and you park everything and it's so great. Like, I never regret it, ever.
Well, that's exactly the point of play TAs. Even if it is child's play, it is keeping the inner child alive. And mothers are in a great position. I mean, obviously a very time poor and probably quite sleep deprived position, but a great position nonetheless, where the inner child is an outer child and they're kind of forcing you to appreciate the world like they do.
Yeah.
And what I try and encourage people who don't have children or whose children are grown up or for whatever reason, to keep that inner child alive some other way. If they don't have an excuse to, you know, play on a slide or whatever, it would be creepy if we all just went to slides in our 30s and 40s. But if there's some other activity that you can do that does give you that same feeling, like I can only imagine the joy of you watching your kids play and watching you play with them and the wonder in their eyes just at leaves or trees or animals or whatever it is, just keeping you in the moment.
Yeah, they do. And, you know, they also challenge you in other ways too.
Yeah.
But they're that and worker, that's it really, at the moment.
Yeah. And that's temporary as well. Different phases of your life, you need different things.
Yeah.
And again, with the goal-kicking thing, I always say there are times when you need to get out of your comfort zone. Mm. There are times when you need it, when you've earned it. You've earned the right to just coast.
And just kind of replenish.
Yeah, and not worry about what else should I be doing, which is also a very hard thing to
for
people
true.
To slow down.
Yeah.
What about you and David?
Yes.
So you guys met.
He's my husband.
Yes, the husband. You met at the Red Stitch Actors.
Well,
is that right?
I'd kind of met him around the traps in Melbourne, sort of theatre. I was aware of him, but we got to know each other at Red Stitch. He auditioned me, actually.
No way!
He directed me in my first play there.
Oh, how lovely!
Yeah.
So, at mentioning that you're time poor, I'm sure this doesn't happen as often as you would like, but what do you guys do for date night? And how do you make time for you guys?
We're not very good at it at the moment, but the plan was, for ages, it was like once a week we have a date night, and that has not happened in some time.
Yes.
But
that's a good aim. Good to set goals.
Good to have goals. We like nothing more than going out to dinner and having a couple of drinks and just talking. But we do – one ritual we do have is we have coffee in the morning together.
Oh, that's
so every morning, bless him, he gets the coffee.
Good deal.
Yep. God love him. And we – before the kids wake up, and we might have, you know, between 10, depending on when they surface, 10 to 20 minutes, and we'll just talk.
Yeah.
And I never get sick of talking.
Yeah.
I'm very lucky that we're still interested in what...
In talking to each other.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know what? I think that's the other thing. Even just 10 minutes a day, it doesn't sound a lot,
but it really
changes the day.
And if I have an early start, if I'm shooting and I'm, you know, I've left the house before he wakes up or whatever, it's I don't like missing that.
Yeah.
I think it's
part
really
of your
important
routine.
Part of our routine, yeah. Just connecting once a day.
And that's the other thing. I think people miss out on those routines a lot in their relationships, but also for themselves, because they have this idea that it has to be an hour of self-care or 2 hours a day or whatever it is. But it's like, you know what? If you just did 5 minutes more consistently, you'd probably be better off than doing 4 hours in a row once a week or whatever it is.
And the night times are unpredictable for us because I tend to put our little girl down and he does stories with our son. And then so that... We're less likely to kind of be able to spend time
overlap.
Together. So but the mornings are ours,
Oh, beautiful. So second last question to finish up. What are three interesting things about you that don't normally come up in interviews? This is where
are
the really interesting stuff comes out.
Okay,
people never think they're interesting.
Well, I'm just going to give you random facts.
Yeah, that's exactly what we want.
Okay, they're probably not very interesting. This is only because I was talking about this the other day. I was obsessed with Olivia Newton-John when I was little. Obsessed. And I was going to have three children, Olivia, Newton, and John.
That's amazing.
True story.
Have you told her?
No, I would love to. I did meet her once and I was pathetic. I was such a fangirl, I kind of just started slurring pretty much, I think. And I just said, I really love you. And what she meant to, you know,
what did she mean to say to that? Thank you. I love you too.
And I said, I don't think you want it. She said, thank you. And I said, I don't think you understand. I've got you on record, cassette, CD, and on iTunes. I've always loved you. And she's like, please make it stop. And she said it with her eyes. She was lovely.
She said it with her eyes.
She was lovely, but I was weird. I was just weird. What else? Why am I telling you this?
Because it's the most interesting part.
All right. When I get a really big fright,
yeah,
I drop to the ground.
No way. Like to the floor.
Yep.
Wow. Wonder where that came from. Can't control it.
It's like a drop. My brother used to do it to me on purpose. Used to give him endless amusement.
Oh my gosh.
Yep. Hours of fun for him. Please don't do that to me if anyone meets me.
I know, how can we?
It takes a lot out of me. I'm like, it takes me a while to recover if I get a really big fright.
Yeah, well, because you've dropped to the ground. You probably injured yourself. Well, you know that now. It's in the bank.
I've got to come up with a third one. Okay, this is going back, way back again. This is really bad.
I remember.
We used to holiday with our cousins and all the girl cousins. My cousins, there were seven of them in this family, big family, and they were all, the four oldest girls were all at least 10 years older than me. And they all had crushes. I was like five. And they all had crushes on, you know, all these
all the
heartthrobs
boys.
And
yeah.
Posters in their rooms and stuff. And I decided as a five-year-old that I should have a crush. Guess who I chose?
Olivia Newton-John.
No. it was Olivia came later.
Oh, okay.
My first official crush, told everyone I loved this person and had their music and talked about them all the time like we were going to get married.
Guess oh, my who? Gosh. Guess who? Give me a clue.
Kenny Rogers.
Oh, my gosh. No. Yeah.
How messed up is that?
So good. See how great that question is? The stuff that comes out,
I'm mortified
it's the
that
best.
I told you all of those things.
I'm honored.
I love
absolutely
you wait till the
honored.
End when the guard's down and I'll pretty much tell you. I have literally told you everything.
Yeah. Oh, the whole point of the whole interview is to warm people up for that question. And the very last question, since I love quotes so much, is what's your favorite quote?
There's, I really like Michael Caine. And I've read several biographies, autobiographies, but he tells the story of being in the army in Korea, and he had to do this patrol with another guy, and they were surrounded, and they thought, okay, we're gonna die, and they said to each other, let's die expensive. So they just decided to just give it a go, and they somehow got out of the situation by firing shots or scaring them off or something, and they made it alive. And I love that idea, die expensive. So even if you think you're going to fail,
yeah,
go out kicking.
That's such a good one. Wow, die expensive. Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. I cannot wait to watch the show tonight. So, so excited for you and can't wait to see how it goes.
Oh, Sarah, thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing.
No, thanks for having me. That was fun.
Yeah.
I told you everything.
I know. I'm like, we're intimate now. So I'll share links in the show notes to everyone for how you can tune in to Kat's episode when Liz comes out for her narration. And, yeah, we'll be following along keenly.
Thank you.
Thanks. It was so, so interesting to meet someone who I feel I know so well, but through so many different roles, none of which are actually who she is at all. What an incredibly talented human, and I cannot wait for tonight's episode of Five Bedrooms, so make sure you tune in at 8:40 p.m. on Channel 10. As always, would love you to share your thoughts or insights from the episode, this podcast episode, or from the episode of the TV show. So take a screenshot now and make sure to tag at @Kat_Stewie, STEWY, and myself. And thank you always for tuning in, and make sure you subscribe too, of course, if you haven't already clicked that button. As a quick aside, it's been a huge week or so at Seize the A. Lol, as if we have an actual HQ. We don't, and we is just me. But I just want to pop a huge thank you in here to everyone for your amazing messages about this month's issue of Women's Health magazine. Each year, the team puts together a Fitfluential list of 25 women in the industry, and I am so flipping stoked to have made the list this year and had the amazing opportunity to participate in the shoot for the feature. It's an absolute dream, so thank you so much to the amazing Jack Mooney and her team at Women's Health. The issue, like every issue, not only features some seriously inspiring women that I admire so much, but is packed, as always, with everything you need to know to stay fit, healthy, and happy. I'm just still pinching myself to be part of it. It's on shelves now with the amazing Steph Claire Smith on the cover for the second time. So grab yours throughout the month. Hope you're having an amazing week and are seizing your yay.